The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're back in our comfortable studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, the headquarters campus here, broadcasting to you live here locally on 101.3 KPCG. And, of course, as we've been advertising on these mini campaigns, we are available on the live stream as well. You can get that at the trumpet.com website or at kpcg.fm. And I know many of you listen to this program a little bit later in the day via the podcast, so you can get that also at the websites. Well, we had a successful run through Phoenix, Los Angeles, and then Sacramento. Hopefully you got a chance to listen to the audio journal, which we played yesterday. And if you haven't, you can get to that at thetrumpet.com, and that just kind of gives you a rundown of the trip and some of the things that we experienced along the way. But it was a successful trip, and hopefully there will be some positive fruit that comes from it in all three of those regions. One of the things that was interesting, just as a side note, in the hotels, of course, they have all the cable news channels. I don't have cable at my house, so I don't watch it that often, although we obviously see some of the clips the next day and such, and we play some of those highlights for you oftentimes. But just having the cable channels, you're able to, after an evening or after whatever you do, get back to the hotel to turn on the news to just see what's going on. And what a crazy week as far as news is concerned. It makes me glad I don't have cable at the house. What a waste of time. So much of it. And they're all saying the same thing. They're all focused on a tweet or a statement. It's as if there's nothing going on in the world. This world is about to explode in violence, and you'd never know it if you're watching MSNBC or CNN. You would never know it. Now, maybe the president is quite good at pushing their buttons and manipulating the press. Some have said that, and there's probably some truth to it. But still, for them to react to every little thing, like a mob, basically. Grabian says that CNN and MSNBC have said the word racist more than 1,100 times since the president's tweet storm on Sunday, when he criticized these ladies that, I forget the exact wording he used, but basically saying, you know, if they don't like it, they should leave. They should go back to their country, or in the case of Ilhan Omar, go back to Ethiopia. If it's so nice there and you hate America, then go back. And so that's what set off the firestorm. 1,100 times. Then last night, the rally, I think it was in North Carolina, and you had some in the crowd chanting, send her back. And again, the reaction, the firestorm of response coming from CNN and MSNBC. This was Joe Scarborough's reaction to the rally last night. This is what he said this morning, clip three.
It's hard to say, actually, that this is shocking, given everything that has preceded this moment. Perhaps everything has led up to this. But this is the low point of, I think it's the low point of the Trump presidency. And I would hope, after last night's shocking display, in any other context, under any other president, at any other time in American history, that we can go ahead and just be done with the fiction that Donald Trump is a bad guy running the country, but those at the rally, we need to try to figure out how to understand them a bit more. They once again made themselves perfectly clear last night.
We need to do away with this fiction that you've got a bad guy in the White House, but the people are pretty good. They're all evil in Joe Scarborough's estimation. So here we are at another low point. This is probably the 1,000th low point for the Trump administration, the way the mainstream media views it. Rasmussen poll, according to Rasmussen, it says 32% of Democrats say that it's racist for any white politician to criticize the political views of a politician of color. It's just racist to criticize them. You can't criticize them. So Ilhan Omar's Twitter feed, that's above any kind of criticism or rebuke. She can say whatever she wants about Jews or whoever. And for the president to criticize her, well, it's obviously racist. Roger Simon at PJ Media says that to say that the Democrats are obsessed with race these days is the equivalent of saying the sky is blue. I'm a racist. You're a racist. Donald Trump's a racist. Nancy Pelosi was a racist until she attacked Trump for racism. Your neighbor's a racist. Your insurance broker's a racist. Your dentist's a racist. As well as your periodontist. All white males are racist. Some white females are racist, especially those married to white males. Everywhere a racist. Never mind that many of those people have no history of racism. It doesn't matter. It does not matter. He says the Dems' presidential campaigns are based around proving the other man or woman is more of a racist and vice versa, or about showing you're not so racist as people say you are, even if you are, or even if you pretended to be a race you weren't. And don't you dare criticize Ilhan Omar, or you're a triple racist, even if her ideas are more racist than anyone else's. Got it? Those are the rules, and we've all got to play along with it. Melanie Phillips had a piece about Donald Trump playing the Democrats at their own race game. That's why they're so furious. He's calling them out. He's exposing the double standard. Phillips says he was using the squad to ram home that the Democrats have been taken over by extremists. That's what he was pointing out on Sunday. And then again on Monday, it says, indeed, for offensiveness, it's hard to beat Ocasio-Cortez, who called the U.S. border detention centers concentration camps. Phillips says, for bigotry, look no further than Omar, who has accused American Jews of dual loyalties and being political influences in the interests of Israel. For anti-Americanism, she's talking about these four women. They came out, I think it was, what was it, Monday, the big press conference, the response to President Trump's tweets. And they had wall-to-wall coverage, carried live all the networks, all the networks. Here are these new, we'll have a story here in just a second, about being led by the children. Here are all these new congresswomen. They've been in office for what, a year? Not even that. Wall-to-wall coverage. Well, it says for anti-Americanism and playing the race card, there's the support by Presley and Tlaib for an article accusing the Declaration of Independence of being sexist, racist, and prejudiced. Not to mention Presley's own racially divisive remark that there's no need for black faces that don't want to be a black voice. If you're a minority and you don't subscribe to our radical leftist views, you don't count, she said. That's one of the four. That's one of the squad. We're being led by children. PJ Media. This is scanning Time Magazine's current roster of the 25 most influential people on the internet. PJ Media says that this doesn't give us much hope for the future of our society. They've got the beauty vlogger on there, something that I was unaware existed until today, says PJ Media. A so-called beauty vlogger, one of the 25 most influential people on the internet. It says, in choosing who made the list, Time evaluated contenders by looking at their global impact on social media and their overall ability to drive news. And so who do we get on this list? James Charles, the so-called beauty vlogger, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. That's Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. You have AOC, Ocasio-Cortez. It says the unranked list also includes such intellectual luminaries as the South Korean pop supergroup BTS, stripper-turned-rapper Cardi B, and a teen star named JoJo Siwa, whose claim to fame is wearing bright colors and playing with unicorns. These are the most influential voices on the internet. It says, being 16 years old and singing catchy, optimistic pop tunes while dressed in intentionally eye-grabbing ways should not elevate someone to the position of influential. Time's inclusion of the young Nebraskan tells me that our society has inverted in how influence is derived. Instead of recognizing, listen to this, and think about Isaiah 3. Instead of recognizing that wisdom comes from experience, we're now led by children. And Time, of course, Time is out there celebrating it. You have to go to PJ Media just to find a pretty good critique. We're being led by children. That's Isaiah 3. It's prophesied. And you watch the news. All through this week, all the cable news channels, and you see, again, you see children. The mentality of children leading the way. The angry, throwing a fit, basically. That's the reaction. And as I said a moment ago, it's as if nothing else is going on in the world. Look at our world today. We just spent a couple of days going through California. And as our driver was pointing out, he works up in the north of the state, collecting meter readings near these fields, these never-ending fields of marijuana. The owners have to guard them from people. They're so popular, people coming in, stealing the marijuana. And they're selling this. It's legal now. They're selling it by the pound. And people are smoking it. They love it, and the politicians love it. They want more freedom. They see this as freedom. And, of course, homeless people by the tens of thousands are free, quote-unquote, free to roam the streets. And you see them all over the place, in L.A., in Sacramento. This world is in trouble. The troubles are intensifying. These troubles are prophesied. A few weeks ago, Los Angeles Times had a column saying Los Angeles, where mega mansions and shanty towns share the same zip code, and where the dark underbelly of a colossal social breakdown is on full display. Full display. You would think the 24-hour news networks could make some time for this. This colossal social breakdown. It's on full display. Everyone in California can see it. There was a CNN headline around the same time, I guess early in June, pointing out that homelessness has gotten a lot worse in L.A. County, despite a huge investment. In other words, they're throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at the problem, and the problem is getting worse. It's getting worse. Last year, California spent $619 million on the housing and services. Well, actually, this is from that Los Angeles Times piece, so I think this is, in fact, L.A. County. $619 million, and yet the homelessness increases by 16%. I've pointed this out before, but there's 60,000 people living on the streets in L.A. County. That's a medium-sized city. We just have 90,000 people in Edmond, a nicer suburb of Oklahoma City. 90,000 people living in Edmond. 60,000 living on the streets of Los Angeles. This column from the LA Times from June 4th, it says, it's fair to wonder what happened and how it's possible to spend all that money only to see the misery multiply and extend deeper into the West Side and the San Fernando and San Gabriel Valleys. It says, but to call homelessness a choice is to dismiss it, is to dismiss the complexities of human frailty. More common on the streets are tangled narratives of trauma, abuse, loss, physical and mental illness, loneliness, addiction, paralyzing poverty, and yes, some peddle drugs, steal, and prey on others to survive. See, how do you fix this? We were driving by a fast food restaurant. A lot of them live in cars, and they've got the cars stacked up with their, well, all their belongings. And in the case of the one we saw, the hatch in the back was opened, and, you know, this is their house. And they stay there in these parking lots until the police force them to move. So you've got all of these restaurant owners and essentially squatters on their property. How do you solve it? How do you fix this? And what are our leaders doing? It says, you might have expected Governor Newsom, who made housing a centerpiece of his campaign, to step in, but instead, he was a ghost. He talked about it during the campaign, but like so many politicians, once they're in office, then they drop it. It says, when it comes to leadership on the interwoven matters of homelessness and the housing affordability crisis, you do not find too many profiles in courage. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti's plan for temporary shelters in every neighborhood has been met with neighborhood pushback, and it hasn't helped that projected costs for these facilities have soared beyond original estimates. So they've got everyone talks and has ideas about what can be done, but nothing gets done. Or if it does, it just piles on the debt. Isaiah 1 and verse 5 talks about the head being sick. The head, that's the leadership. And then you keep reading into verse 6, and it talks about the whole body. The whole body is sick from head to toe. The Los Angeles Times column says, L.A. has been trashed partly because of the spread of encampments, partly because of illegal dumping, partly because the city can't keep up with desperate calls for help. And so California is being trashed. You don't have to go back that far to see the blessings and the wealth and the prosperity that God poured down upon this state, the Golden State. Go back to the 1950s and 60s. When people couldn't wait to get to California. Time magazine had a piece in 1963 about the population boom in the 1950s and 60s and what brought people in. It said the oil wells, the fishing industry, the availability of the beautiful mountains and beaches, the neat, prim charm of the sun-baked villages of the South, the excellence of the schools, the fertility of the land, and the forests of the North. It had a little bit of everything. And people poured in. But that started to change coming into the 1970s, the 1980s, and 90s. This article, also from Time, 1991, it says, California's fabled magnetism is reversing itself. The escapee, this is in 91. This is long before the homelessness epidemic. But it says here, California's failed magnetism is reversing itself. The escapees are being driven away by an accelerating deterioration in the quality of life. Clogged freeways, eye-stinging smog, despoiled landscapes, polluted beaches, water shortages, unaffordable housing, overcrowded schools and beleaguered industries, many of which are fleeing with their jobs to other states. The very qualities that have lured millions to California for 50 years are threatening to disappear. Well, they have. They have disappeared. And this should stand as a warning for us, because as California goes, so goes the rest of the nation. We're all heading in that direction. We're so far gone. Marijuana fields for as far as the eye can see. And just driving through parts of Sacramento, how sad to see the way that some people are living. These are problems that man cannot fix, that man will not fix. Only God. I read through 1 Peter 4 in one of my campaign lectures, 1 Peter 4 and verse 7, where it says, "But the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer." The end of all things, it's at hand. There's a lot in the Bible. There's a lot in the New Testament about the end of all things. Even the disciples in Matthew 24, remember they came to Jesus and they said, "Hey, tell us, what's going to be the sign of your coming and the end of this world?" They were concerned about it. Shouldn't we be? They were wondering about end time events, prophesied events, the return of Jesus Christ. Seems like we should be concerned about it. But they're not concerned about it at MSNBC or CNN. They're not concerned about really anything other than tweets. The other day, July 14th, Bastille Day in France. And there were troops from 10 European countries in this parade through Paris. Did that get any coverage on the cable news networks? Deutsche Welle says troops from 10 countries took part in the European Intervention Initiative and paraded down the streets of Paris. A total of 4,000 military personnel, 69 military airplanes, and 39 helicopters were involved in the display. How did the media react to this? Did they react the same way they did when Donald Trump gave a July 4th speech alongside an Abrams tank? You listen to the coverage then, and it's if he's the worst authoritarian dictator in human history. And then in France, 10 days later, on Bastille Day, you had troops and armaments coming from 10 countries, of all things, parading through Paris. That's pretty amazing. And it's amazing, isn't it, that there were 10 nations. Now, those 10 nations included the UK, and it didn't include nations from the eastern leg of the oncoming European Empire. But still, isn't it interesting that France was putting the focus on a 10-nation military combine when you think about Revelation 17 and verse 12, the 10 kings, well, that's significant. There's many leaders pushing for a stronger European Union, pushing for the formation of a European army. Ursula von der Leyen, she's one of them. The first woman to run the European Commission, she was voted in just this week. She succeeds Jean-Claude Juncker on October 31st, which is also, of course, the deadline for Brexit. So these are some pretty significant developments. We're in the midst of quite a transition. Britain on the way out. And now Ursula von der Leyen, she's Germany's defense minister. She heads up the European Commission. I mean, she has been pushing and pushing and pushing for a European army. Listen to what Nigel Farage, he's, of course, heading up the Brexit movement in the European Parliament. Listen to what he had to say about, I think this was just before von der Leyen was voted in. Clip one.
What you've seen from Ursula von der Leyen today is an attempt for the European Union to take control of every single aspect of our lives. She wants to build a centralised, undemocratic, updated form of communism that will render nation-state parliaments, where the state controls everything, where nation-state parliaments will cease to have any relevance at all.
There's Nigel Farage basically being shouted down in the European Parliament because he's there saying this is not a democratic union at all. This is a union that's imposing its will on all of Europe. And he went on to say, I'm so thankful we're leaving. We're getting out of here. Here's what he went on to say about the push to build a European army. Listen to this quote, clip two.
But it is in the aspect of defense that I think people's minds should be focused. She's a fanatic for building a European army, but she's not alone. When it's completed, NATO will cease to exist or have any relevance in Europe at all. And of course, not to be left out of this, French President Emmanuel Macron, on Bastille Day last Sunday, stood at the front of an open-top car with his nascent European Defence Force behind him, looking for all the world like an updated version of Napoleon. Be in no doubt, 5 years of these people, the European Defence Union will be complete. And what is there for defence can also be used for attack. And you as a house will have no control over it.
That's Nigel Farage just the other day. Wow. What's there for defense can also be used for attack. She's a fanatic for building a European army. And as we see this develop, it's going to, well, NATO's going to cease to exist. Now, the cable channels, they don't care a thing about NATO unless it's Donald Trump tweeting about everyone paying their fair share. Then they're really concerned about NATO. Here she's a fanatic. This is the woman heading up the European Commission now. A fanatic for building a European army. Well, it's all for defense. But as Nigel Farage just pointed out there, what's there for defense can also be used for an attack. What about the military display on Bastille Day? Where's this headed? What's France and Macron? What are they trying to promote here? France maintains goal of creating a European army, says the French defense minister. That's France's ambition, he said in a recent interview. The French defense minister, you've got the German defense minister. She's a fanatic for building a European army. Well, she's not going to be the strong man, von der Leyen. But there are plenty of calls in Europe for the strong man. That's not going to make news on CNN or MSNBC either. The EU Observer recently had a piece, Rudderless Europe. Will the real Germany please stand up? That's the headline. It says the EU might be relieved to have cobbled together a deal. But make no mistake, Europe is increasingly rudderless. And Europe is floundering because Germany refuses to lead. So yet another commentary urging Germany to step forward. Urging Germany to take the lead. It says a new chancellor, an able German commission president, and Brexit presents a new opportunity to reset Berlin's vision for the future of Europe by placing itself confidently at the heart of Europe. Germany needs to set out its vision for the future of the EU. Listen to this conclusion. This is, again, from the EU Observer. It says, but to do this, to really lead and shape Europe, Berlin must realize that you can't live in fear of the future by trying to remedy the past. Germany deserves more. So does Europe. So here's a prominent EU publication once again saying that Germany should forget about its past, forget about its history, and just take charge. Just take over. Just take the lead. And you've got all of the commentators across the Atlantic saying that Donald Trump is Hitler and that the detention centers at the border, that's concentration camps. And they miss everything that's going on, that's actually going on, that's actually happening in the world. There was a story, I mentioned it in one of the campaign stops, about the United States reaction to Turkey. Turkey's program or its deal with Russia to get this missile defense system. And the U.S. considered this a dangerous threat and told Turkey, look, if you don't back out of this deal with Russia on the missile defense system, then we're going to back out on our deal with you to supply you with 100 F-35 stealth fighter jets. Think about Turkey having 100 F-35s. Just Turkey. This is just one nation among many. The world is turning into an armed camp. The world is arming for war. And these kinds of dealings, they're just routine. Russia supplying Turkey with the missile defense and America supplying Turkey with F-35s. Here's an article. German arms exports to Ankara continued despite escalating Greek-Turkish crisis. Hasn't stopped Germany from continuing to export arms to Turkey. Everyone does it. Germany, Russia, the U.S. Well, now the U.S. is upset, so maybe they don't deliver the F-35s, but you get the idea. You see what's happening. This article says only last year, deliveries to Turkey made up almost one-third of all German arms exports. That's something like 770 million euro. The world is preparing for war, but you'd never know it. You'd never know it. Watching the 24-hour cable news networks. Their only war, the only war they're concerned about, is their war against President Trump. In the old Ambassador College Bible correspondence course, one of the cover letters says, a hot World War III is coming. It says here, we know how the United States of Europe will be used by Germany to attempt world domination. Prophecy shows 10 kings, 10 dictators will arise in Europe and give their power to Germany. That is what's prophesied. That is what should be the headline. That is what should be featured on the news shows. And yet you hear nothing about it. 1 Peter 4 and verse 7, once again it says, "But the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer." Be sober and watch unto prayer. My father says in the Peter booklet, the fact that Christ's return is so near should change our behavior. This is a theme I keep coming back to at these campaigns. We're getting so close. It should change our behavior. It should stir us to action. The knowledge of Christ's imminent return should make us urgent spiritually. That's what my father wrote. We are facing terrifying times now just ahead of us. And God wants the reality of this coming crisis. He wants it to motivate us to change our lives, to help us give more to his work, to give more in support of his work, to turn our hearts to him in repentance and faith. When we come back, we'll go through some of the material my father sent out last night in a special trumpet brief. He had some wonderful comments there about how important these youth programs are that the Philadelphia Church of God sponsors. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
Trumpet Daily.
My father sent out a special trumpet brief last night to all of our, I think, 25,000 trumpet brief subscribers. He talks about the campus and how there's a little more noise on campus right now with 132 campers enjoying all of these wonderful activities. I was able to speak to them after returning yesterday. In two lectures during the afternoon, and some of them were hobbling in a little bit from their bumps and bruises and the games that have now started, basketball games, soccer, flag football for the fellas, and volleyball, and quite a few other things as well. And we've got staff here supporting this this program. As I was telling the campers yesterday, it's like one big group date, as they're able to get to know other young people from both sexes, people of a like mind, and yet it's very structured, and it's a chaperoned group date with counselors and assistant counselors and then workers and ministers and staff coming from all over the world. Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, the United States, of course. My father says these camps are far more important than is immediately apparent. They are a vision of how God will correct the problems of this entire world very soon. You go back to what I covered in the first segment. Look at the streets of our cities. Look at what's happening to our families. And when you come to this camp, you're able to peer into another world. A world that will soon correct the problems of this present evil world. My father says that he refers to Isaiah 3 and verse 8 and how the fact that our nations are ruined. They are ruined. And the main reason for this is because of the upside down family. The main reason for this is because children are ruling instead of submitting, instead of honoring their parents. Oh, my people, they which lead you cause you to err and to destroy the way of your paths. Women rule over them, it says. Children are their oppressors. That's Isaiah 3 and verse 12. My father says this means many of the nation's young people are unprepared to face life. This is a major reason so many turn to drugs and other forms of escapism. See, you can buy marijuana by the pound. You can just put a big stack of it up in your kitchen and smoke it all day if you like. Young people turning to escapism, utterly unprepared for life, for the responsibilities of marriage and family. I was telling the young people yesterday that Mr. Armstrong taught us that marriage is a career. And just like with any other career that you would pursue in university or wherever, you have to prepare for it. You have to be educated. You have to understand why marriage. You have to know and understand and learn the roles in marriage, the God-ordained roles. They're all laid out there for men and women. So much valuable instruction. It's all there in the Holy Book. The God-inspired, the God-breathed book, but nobody uses it. Nobody reads it. Nobody studies God's truth. Instead, we turn to drugs and other forms of escapism. My father says between 2008 and 2015, suicide among school-age children and adolescents in the U.S. more than doubled. So they're turning to all forms of escapism, and more young people are just ending their lives altogether. It says among this young group, suicide is the second leading cause of death after unintentional injuries. My father writes, something is dreadfully wrong with our young people. This is a crisis that God cares deeply about. He refers to Herbert Armstrong. He refers to all of the youth programs that he started, YOU, the youth camps, the academy, the college. Malachi 4, 5, and 6. A prophecy that an end-time Elijah would turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Bring the family together. You can look at what Mr. Armstrong was doing and saying and really emphasizing the last 7 years of his life when he was in his late 80s and early 90s. He was talking mostly about the youth programs. Well, he certainly emphasized it. I don't know the exact proportion compared to other subjects, but he started the youth magazine in 1981. This is just 5-6 years before he died. And the camp and youth programs, they were bigger than ever during the 1980s. That's when I went. He really emphasized family. He was a family builder. It says Malachi 4 applies to God's spiritual family and the physical family. God insists that we turn the heart of the children to their fathers. To do this properly, the family must be turned to God and His love. In my camper orientation lecture, that first night last week, I talked about loyalty and how important it is for you young people, I said, you young people, to be loyal to God, to be loyal to God's law, and to be loyal even to your own parents. You represent their family name. You don't want to bring shame on their name. That's the message they're receiving at this camp. And they should be proud of their family. They should be proud of the God family. What God is building, it's the solution to all the evils in this world. My father says, soon the whole world is going to be ready to be taught. God's church, including our children, must be ready for this gigantic job. He refers to, again, the prophesied Elijah, Luke 1 and verse 17, and then says, God says we must prepare our youth and adults for the return of Jesus Christ. We must be prepared for the return of Jesus Christ. The end of all things is near, as I read in the last segment. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer. This is all part of the preparation. We've got to be prepared for what's coming. We're working hard at this camp to prepare these young people for their future, for the return of Jesus Christ, for their entry into the family of God. Well, they're already in it, in embryo. God's family, it's about to spring forth and cover all the earth. He says finally in this trumpet brief, what we're doing at the Philadelphia Youth Camp helps prepare our youth to assist Christ in changing the world, even the universe. God has a lot of care and concern for our young people. Jesus Christ wants to use them to help teach the whole world. And so he says here, we work hard to teach our youth that vision. We work hard to give them that vision. Yesterday I read to them 1 John 3. I'll just wrap things up with this passage. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 1. Notice what it says here. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. What manner of love is this? That we should be called God's sons? The children of God in God's family? That's right. That's what God's offering. What manner of love is this? God says, behold, take note of this. Consider this. We're the sons of God. And sons, obedient sons, they honor their father by obeying his law, by following in Christ's steps. Be loyal, loyal to the law of God, loyal to God our Father. Verse 2 says, beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, that's speaking of Christ, and when he shall appear at his return, we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. We're going to be just like him at the return of Christ, born into the family of God, resurrected as a glorified spirit being, immortal, eternally living, sons of God, family of God. That's the vision. that we work hard to teach our young people at this camp and at all camps. And it says in verse 3, every man that has this hope in him purifies himself, even as he is pure. If you have this hope, then you automatically go to work purifying yourself. Notice the order in these two verses, verses 2 and 3. First, God gives us this royal family vision. First, God gives us this hope. First, God says, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God? If you have this hope, then you are purifying yourself, even as God is pure. This purification process, it leads us right into the family of God. God gives us this incredible, transcendent vision about being sons of God. And then he starts talking about the royal law. And this is not a new subject. It's not a subject change. It's God's royal family, after all. And our job for all eternity will be administering God's royal law. God's government. God family government. Verse 4 says, whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. We need this vision, and we need this holy law. My father wrote in the last hour, John taught the God family vision first. Behold, what manner of love, he said. He inspired people with the vision. And then he said, if this is what you want, you must keep the law. If this is what you want, you must observe the law. You must submit to God's government. You must embrace this truth. This is what we work hard to teach our youth at PYC. God says judgment. It begins at the house of God. It begins in the church of God. That's 1 Peter 4:17. We're being judged, we in God's church. We're being judged according to how we're living right now. We're all under detailed inspection. God's carefully scrutinizing our lives, our marriages, our families, our young people, our children. He has to. He's preparing us for marriage to Jesus Christ. And so we have to continually remind our young people who they are, what they're part of, where this is leading. The Key of David booklet says we must continually remind our young people that they are God's princes and princesses of the earth. They're part of the first fruits calling. They need this vision stamped in their thinking, emblazoned in their minds. My father gave a message last weekend about the importance of vision. Where there is no vision, the people perish, but he that keeps the law, happy is he. Well, even in that proverb, you see it relate. You see how closely it relates to this passage in 1 John 3. In one verse, you read about the vision and the law. Just like 1 John 3, verses 2 and 3. Verse 2 says, beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know. We know when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And then right after that, God says, every man that has this hope in him purifies himself, even as he is pure. And so we have this royal, holy law that we can use to go about our day-by-day purification process. God gives us these laws to ensure happiness and peace and security and plenty, as Mr. Armstrong wrote in The Missing Dimension in Sex. He wants us to lead thrilling, radiant, joyous lives. That's what God wants for us. That's what he wants for our young people, as I told them yesterday. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on yet another broadcast here in our Edmond studio in the heart of Oklahoma, right in the middle of the great state of Oklahoma. Email us if you like, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.